Good morning. Welcome to Senate Finance. Today is Thursday, January 19, 2017. The time is 9:03 a.m. if you're joining us off net or online. We are in Alaska State Capitol and the fifth floor in Senate Finance. With me this morning, Co-Chairman Hoffman. Welcome.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Machicki.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator von Himhoff.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Good morning.
Senator Dunleavy.
Good morning.
And myself, Senator Anna McKinnon, Co-Chair of Finance. On today's agenda is an overview of the 2016 fall revenue forecast. All of our documents are available online if you go to alaskaledge.gov and click on the Senate Finance Committee. Commissioner Hoffback, if we'd like to welcome you today. If you could identify yourself for the microphone and those listening at home, and then please present your presentation. It's my time.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. I also have with me today Dan Stickle, our Chief Economist. Dan will walk us through primarily through the presentation, but I did want to make a few opening comments and deal with one issue before we move into the forecast. I wanted to talk, first of all, about the one major methodological change that we made this year, which was in our production forecasting method in the forecast. We had an opportunity this year because of an expired contract. The Department of Revenue has used contract assistance for doing the forecast for many, many years, probably 30 years. Our most recent contract expired this year. We looked at it as an opportunity to save money in light of the fact that DNR also does production forecasting. And instead of Department of Revenue doing an independent forecast, we felt like if we could work with the Department of Natural Resources, and we could use the Department of Natural Resources forecast and save ourselves the contract fee, which was over $100,000 a year. We worked with the Department of Natural Resources, were able to come up with a methodology that had the breadth and scope that we needed for the revenue forecast, but yet did not change the methodology that they would use in forecasting the fields. There are certain advantages to DNR doing it. First of all, they have data that a contractor doesn't have. A contractor had to rely a large part on publicly available data. DNR, of course, has much more detailed data. Secondly, our contractor was from out of state. And so he simply was not, following the fields as closely as DNR does on a daily basis. So we really felt like DNR would give us a stronger, more robust forecast in the long term. That being said, I think there's been a lot of discussion around the fact that right now our forecast it appears to be running low. The forecast for the fiscal year was for fiscal year 17 was 490,000 barrels a day. We're currently running about 510,000 barrels a day for the annual average, and our daily throughput right now is about 550,000 barrels a day. Obviously, we're in the peak season right now, the cold winter months where compression is most efficient is when they can produce the most. We expect that we will see declines starting in April, May, June. We'll see lower production rates, but right now we are running substantially higher than the forecast. We do have individuals here from DNR that can talk about their forecasting methodology if you want to take a deeper dive into it. But we did backtest the methodology when we first looked at it. We feel that over time it's going to be robust. It's going to be a good methodology. But we are running greater production now than what we had forecast in the fall forecast.
Mr. Hoffbeck, thank you for anticipating my question. I was wondering if we looked in the rearview mirror to see if the numbers somehow align. I would like to take a moment to acknowledge that Senator David Wilson has joined us in the gallery today. Welcome, Senator Wilson. Commissioner Hoffbeck, please continue.
One other number to deal with is the price forecast. We had forecasted 46.81 for fiscal year 17. Right now, year to date, we're at $46.92 average, but we are our daily prices now are bouncing around between $52 and $54 a barrel. Mr. Stegall will have a chart later on in his presentation that will show the impact on that if it stays there, but it would amount to a couple of dollars a barrel by the end of the year if the prices stay where they are now. Put it in perspective, a dollar per barrel is worth about $30 million in revenue in long term. Putting in perspective production, 50,000 barrels a day average change is worth about $100 million, just to factor that into what our revenues may be at the end of this year. Two other changes in the book this year. We have a Chapter 1 that was not a part of the book before that deals with revenues available for appropriation. Last year, we started moving towards this with just a couple of charts in the book. This year, we actually included an entire chapter, primarily in response to talking with investors and bond rating agencies and those that when all we talked about was unrestricted general fund revenues and didn't take into account other revenues such as investment revenues, that we showed, you know, that $3 billion, $4 billion deficits over the years, when in fact, if you counted in our investment revenues, we really were not running at those kind of deficits. And so we wanted to have a discussion in the book so that when we're meeting with these agencies, it's not something that they haven't seen before, something they feel like that we're spinning up in the conversation, but it's part of our official documentation. So you'll see Chapter 1 in there deals with revenues available for appropriation. And then Chapter 3 this year, which is generally dedicated to a specific topic, this year it talks about sales tax and income tax, and just kind of gives a foundation for a broader discussion on broad-based taxes if, in fact, that's where the legislature moves this year. So those are the changes in the revenue forecast this year.
Mr. Hoffbeck, and this document is available online at the Department of Revenue also and has been delivered to all the senators' offices.
And with that, I will turn it over to Dan Stickle if there are no questions.
If I could, Commissioner, I wanted to let you know that online we have Jim Schein, Steve Muthart, Pascal Yimqui, and Paul Becker. So you do have staff that's available for the committee's questions. In addition, in the audience, we have Deputy Commissioner Jerry Burnett. So just, and the other informative piece I'd like to provide the committee is that our Resource Committee will be doing a deep dive on the DNR forecast and the model that the Commissioner just spoke about. Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Hoffbeck, in your opening letter, you highlight the fact that we've increased to an average of 531,500 barrels per day, an increase from the 519,200 barrels per day in FY15, the first increase since 2002. Do you venture to speculate on the reason for that increase in this challenging price environment?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, there's several things involved with it. One is, I think, is partially a statistical anomaly that we saw that in the prior 2 years there were fairly lengthy and robust turnarounds in fields. They did a lot of debottlenecking and those kind of things to allow for them to deal with additional gas and water handling. So those came into play. And in the last fiscal year, they had a shorter turnaround. So there was actually less downtime. So there was that statistical piece about it. But then there's been new oil brought online as well. So I think it's a combination of the two that created that upswing. But the fields are still on decline, and if we don't bring in new fields, new developments, we will go back into a decline very quickly.
Senator Machicki.
Just a brief follow-up. So you're not going to go as far as to say that the change in tax policy could have resulted in greater investment in a couple of those developments?
So the chair, Senator Machicki, certainly tax policy makes a difference. Some of the fields that have come online were pre-tax policy, and they were sanctioned prior to that. Other investments were made because of the tax policy and the ability to write off the investments against the tax liability. So I wouldn't say that, no. I would say that it's a combination of a lot of things, and tax policy is one of them.
Thank you, Senator Michiki. Commissioner, I'll follow up on that. Do you have a number of new I've started reading the revenue resource book and have it highlighted on multiple pages, but can you give me a specific number on new oil? Do you have that, or do you know it?
Madam Chair, I don't have it right off the top of my head, but we can get that number for you.
It would be good to know, just for contrast between the two different ideas or thoughts for the additional production. We have heard several announcements of late where companies are asserting that they may put 100,000 barrels of new oil in the pipe. Not sure the timeline on some of those investments. There are some that are even more remote that could have significant numbers but also require significant investment to reach that oil, and I'm not sure how proven those finds are at this point. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, through Chair. Just a follow-up in the opening statements. Commissioner, it appears that worldwide, the past 2 years, exploration, development, rig count, et cetera, was down. And as a result of decisions made by OPEC, there appears to be a view, some internationally, that price is rebounding or is destined to rebound. And when we look at that scenario, can you just help me, and maybe I'm misinterpreting this and you'll explain it here, but can you help me understand why it appears that our forecasts are running somewhat a counter to what appears to be international forecasts is more optimistic on price per barrel?
Through the Chair, Senator Dunleavy, the reason that we're a little bit low on the price forecast is because the forecast was made prior to Saudi agreeing to the OPEC reduction in production. And so that almost instantaneously created a $7 to $10 bump in the price of oil. So that's one of the reasons that we're running low on the forecast. That being said, I think we're starting to already see a response in the oil patch in the lower 48 in the shale oil. Rigs are coming back online, and I think people are looking at that $60 price point as kind of at least a temporary ceiling. That's going to bring a lot of oil online. We'll get into an oversupply situation again, and the price is going to bounce around. It's going to be pretty volatile, but that's going to be bouncing around in that $50-$60 price range. So we forecast 56 for next year, 60 the year after. So and we'll look at the prices again in the spring with an eye on whether the OPEC deal is held and whether it looks like it's going to hold.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Senator Dunleavy. Senator Michiki, followed by Senator Bishop.
No, thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I appreciate the cautious approach to forecasting. I think that helps us with our job, too, to keep pressure on the budget, to keep it right there on the edge, if you will, notwithstanding our life, safety, and health departments that we need to keep up and functional to provide services to the state. But I like the cautious forecasting. Helps us keep downward pressure on the budget, but it also, if we get a swing, helps us build our reserves back as well. So I'd rather come in low and see a higher price and at the end of the year is sort of like a windfall bonus, if you will. So that's just my opinion.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Commissioner Hoffbeck, please continue.
With that, I'll turn it over to Dan Stickle to walk through the presentation.
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Alaska Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to present our revenue sources book today. Starting with a few high-level trends, and then we'll jump into some of the details on the various revenue sources. In FY 2016, the average oil price for Alaska North Slope crude was $43 a barrel. Over the coming decade, we're projecting increases of approximately 7% per year on average. In FY16, Alaska North Slope oil production amounted to about 515,000 barrels per day, and the forecast assumes an average decline of 4% annually over the coming decade. Again, in FY16, general fund unrestricted revenue was approximately $1.5 billion, and we are projecting increases of about 5% annually from that value. Investment income also expected to increase at about 5% on average over the forecast period, while total state revenue, which is unrestricted revenue plus all the other sources of revenue, we're projecting about a 2% annual increase on that. The next slide is our standard disclaimer that we give at the beginning of all of these presentations. The main point here is this is a forecast. Our forecast has a lot of uncertainty around it. We've done our best to present what we view as the most likely case, but please understand that there's a range of possible outcomes around that. As the commissioner mentioned, for this forecast, oil price and oil production are already trending a little bit above what's included in the forecast.
Madam Chair.
Senator Michicki.
We said it a little bit earlier this year, I believe, but I want to reiterate my appreciation for your conservatism in your forecasting. We hammered Department of Revenue and DNR for an unrealistically improbable rosy view of production and oil prices for the first 2 years that I was here, and I appreciate we have to manage for a realistic case, and we can celebrate if your conservatism results in a higher number when the fiscal year is over. And I'd rather look at it that way than the way that we did before. Remember, price forecasts in the above $100 range, and I don't know that we can ever count on much above 60. For the distant future, I think there has been a reset, and I appreciate it. I think you responded, whether you responded to the legislature or you responded to the market. Either way, I think it's a more realistic view. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Michicki.
Okay, so in the Revenue Sources book, what do we forecast? The Economic Research Group within Department of Revenue, we maintain a series of models for the various petroleum revenues as well as the non-petroleum revenues, taxes, and other non-petroleum revenues. For the investment revenue, we work in collaboration with the Permanent Fund Corporation and the Treasury Division of the Department of Revenue. Those investment forecasts are based primarily on the expectations from Callan Associates, which is the consultant to both of those organizations. For federal revenue, we don't attempt to estimate what the federal government is going to do several years into the future. The federal revenue forecast represents the total authorized spending in the budget, and typically what comes into the state is a little bit lower than the federal revenue forecast, so just something to be aware of when looking at that. So petroleum revenue historically in many years has represented 80% to 90% of the unrestricted revenue to the state. Going forward, we're anticipating that petroleum revenue will still comprise the majority of unrestricted revenue, about 70%. So that's where the majority of this presentation will focus. Four factors we look at in estimating petroleum revenue: obviously the level of production of oil as well as the price of oil are very important. Given that we have a net profits-based tax that allows for deductibility of expenditures as well as various tax credits that are based on company spending, we also take a look at costs. The capital and operating expenditures from the companies as well as transportation costs. And we'll walk through each of those four items in the coming set of slides. So starting with the production forecast, as the commissioner mentioned, we made a methodology change this year to incorporate work done by the Department of Natural Resources. So this first slide shows a comparison of some of the methodology components of that forecast, how they were done with the previous engineering consultant and how they're being approached by Department of Natural Resources. A couple of the key changes here is they have switched from a well-by-well forecast where our consultant was attempting to estimate the production from each individual well on the slope and sum those up to a pool-level forecast. So for each of the oil fields, they're doing a separate forecast for the entire field. Also, another important change is the time horizon of the forecast. Previously, any production expected to begin within the next 10 years was evaluated for inclusion in the forecast. DNR has switched to a five-year outlook. So if there's a new find out there that's expected to come online anywhere after 5 years from now, that would not be included in the forecast. I should mention that particular change, while a salient point, did not drop any production out of the forecast this year.
Thank you. If you could pause for a moment. Senator Michiki.
Sometimes it takes a minute for things to sink in for me, but you, when you talk about the federal revenue authorized for spending as the forecast, and it's typically 20% to 30%, I'll just say off. And then you're looking at federal revenues and the total state revenue. You had, for FY16, you had $2.5 billion, $3.5 billion in 17, $3.1 billion in 18. If you're 20 to 30% off, that's a real number. How do you account for a $600 million difference in this forecast?
Mr. Hoffbeck.
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. The amount that's authorized is the amount that we could theoretically be able to capture in federal revenue. Most of them are match associated, and so we would need to do a 100% spend on our part to qualify for all of it, and typically we don't make all the qualifying expenditures, and therefore we come up 20 or 30% less than what we could have achieved, but we just simply don't do the work necessary to qualify for all of the federal revenue.
Senator Michiki.
That's a very different. So essentially, the number that you're predicting in your forecast would be that total program dollars that would be available if we went for every match. So it's not really a revenue number.
Senator Michiki, could you speak into the microphone?
Yes.
We can't hear exactly what you're saying.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. Is there another way for us to have a more realistic view of those federal receipts?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, we certainly could risk the amount that we feel like we would capture and adjust that downward on an annual basis. That would certainly be something we could consider for future forecasts.
Senator Michiki, follow up?
I'm okay. Thank you.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Commissioner Hoffbeck, on the subject of federal, I think it's worth noting that it could potentially decrease in the years to come with the new presidential administration. And I worry with the decrease in Medicaid funding and how that will affect our budget. And we have ramped up over the last year quite a bit of health care. That's the one sector that has expanded. And if we decrease the federal funding, how are we going to respond to that? And how quickly can we unramp if that scenario occurs? So I was just curious if you've done potential modeling of potential outcomes of what could happen.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, Department of Revenue has not modeled the unwinding. I would assume that the Department of Health and Human Services has modeled it, but we have not been asked to model unwinding of the Medicaid expansion.
Mr. Hoffbeck, if we could continue.
Yeah. Sure. Again, for the record, Dan Stickel with Department of Revenue. So I think we've completed this slide. The next slide is the familiar production mountain chart that we present every year. This shows a history of oil production on the North Slope since the start of production there, as well as a 10-year forecast by the various fields. As you can see, in the late 1980s, Alaska North Slope oil production peaked at just over 2 million barrels a day, and since then, with a few exceptions, notably last year as well as the start of Alpine in the early 2000s, with those exceptions, production has generally been declining since the peak in the 1980s. And today we are a little bit over 500,000 barrels a day and projected to decline at 4% annually during the forecast period.
Mr. Stickler, if you could pause for a moment. We do have two other resources in the room that I want to make sure that I highlight. Mr. Ken Alper, the Division of Tax Director, is in the room, as well as Chantel Walsh, our new Director of the Division of Oil and Gas. I just want to welcome everyone who's online and available to help us. Maybe if we have a few minutes at the end, we'll ask Chantel Walsh if she wants to come up and just say a couple of remarks to introduce herself to the Senate Finance team, if she can stay in the room, and if not, that's fine. Mr. Sickle, please continue.
Thank you. So in producing the production forecast, oil production and potential production is divided into four categories, which are currently producing, under development, under evaluation, and excluded from forecast. Starting with the currently producing category, that is all oil from currently producing pools and wells. These are the fields that are online now, as well as in forecasting currently producing production, the Department of Natural Resources looks at a certain amount of background ongoing activity. So if a particular field typically has two wells drilled per year, and that's been the historical case, then they would project that same level of drilling forward in the currently producing category. The under development category would be any production in currently producing fields above and beyond that baseline level of work, as well as new fields that are expected to start production within the next year. This is a bit of a change from the previous methodology that looked at a little bit longer time horizon. So this is any new production coming on with the next year. And an example of under development in the fall 2016 forecast would be continued build out of the CD5 development in the Kolwa River unit. Projects under evaluation then are projects that have enough certainty in them to be included in the forecast. We look at facility sharing agreements, funding, progress in EIS and facilities, things like that. And these are volumes that are expected to start production within the 2 to 5 year time horizon, which would be by the end of fiscal year 2021. Some examples of under evaluation oil that is included in the fall forecast are additional developments at Ugarook, some additional developments in the Kuparuk River unit, as well as the Mustang field, and the Greater Moose's Tooth unit as well. And then finally, excluded from forecast, this is going to be any oil that would have a first oil date beyond 5 years, as well as other oil that does not have enough level of certainty to be included in the forecast. And on the slide here, we've listed several different types of uncertainty that we would look at: technological, environmental, economic. So this is a number of very exciting announcements and finds that are out there that have great potential to add to the production and revenue forecast in the future. Pikka, Smith Bay, the recent Willow announcement by ConocoPhillips would all be examples of oil production that is not currently included in the revenue forecast.
If we could pause. Are there questions from committee members? Senator Michicki.
Just a question for you. Thank you. Through the chair, when you evaluate a new find, an assessment of a new find by various types of players that we have on the North Slope, do you work with the DNR on the accuracy probabilities? Not every company evaluates as accurately as others. Is that something that you have an exercise in risking out the probabilities of their success?
Absolutely, Senator Michicki, through the chair. So the first thing we do in evaluating a find like that is we compare it to this criteria for the under evaluation category and say, is the expected start date within within the next 5 years, and does it meet the criteria for undervaluation, category one or two? And then if the project does meet those criteria, then DNR would include it in the forecast, and they have, in their modeling, developed a set of risk factors for each individual field to account for the exact risks that you mentioned. And when we invite them up, they might be able to speak in a little more detail to those risk factors.
Thank you, Senator Machicki. Mr. Stickle, I have a question as far as a follow-up on this slide. We have had this presentation before in quantifying and setting the criteria on how this evaluation goes forward, and I'm wondering if the characteristics that you're describing today are any different than those that we've received in past years. Specifically, I'll call out uncertain financing. I don't recall seeing that in past forecasts. Facilities incomplete or non-existent, or technology uncertainty. So, you know, those can roll into other language. I understand that. So there could be other words that have been used in the past. But is there new characteristics that you're taking on this year as you've relied on DNR and then tried to mitigate any differences in bringing it forward to us today?
Sure, Madam Chair. I think one thing we looked at is developing a more robust definition for the currently producing, under development, and under evaluation categories. So, yes, we've added some additional terms and really tried to make add a little bit of clarity to what we're looking at in putting a particular field in one of those categories or not.
As Vice Chairman Bishop pointed out, I appreciate the conservative approach to accurately defining so that the general public can understand what you're including in each of those categories. My question is on, and I might not have this right, is it the PICA field that was just announced with 100,000 barrels of potential to go into the pipe? Do I have that right?
So the
it's Willow. Thank you.
Correct. Willow is the recent ConocoPhillips announcement.
And could you help me then? Is that inside of the forecast, or is Willow beyond the five-year time frame?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Willow is a new announcement that's been made in the time since we actually put the forecast together. That would most likely fall. Well, it definitely is not in this particular forecast. As we put together the spring forecast and then the next fall's forecast in particular, we'll be talking with the operator and getting more information about that development and evaluating it for possible inclusion in the future forecast.
So it's not included. Is there any others? I noticed that you give us a PICA is in the examples as part of the characteristics. What was moved? Can you tell us from a field perspective, with this new defined clarity, what was moved into the either undefined or current forecast versus
sure,
under development?
Sure, Madam Chair, and we could provide a more specific list. No fields were moved out of the forecast. So there's no production that was in the forecast last time around that came out of the forecast this time around. There was some moving between under development and under evaluation, just given the new time horizons that we
put on those.
Is
that consistent then with general accounting practices as far as the reserves for accounting standards? Is that what we're aligning with, or I understand you're going after clarity and the company's book reserves, and those books are of value to the overall company when they go after bonding or other sorts of financing. Are we consistent with that? Are we more conservative than that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, so reserves are one thing that we look at and Department of Natural Resources looks at. The categories we've set up are not exactly mimicking any accounting definitions of reserves.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Getting back to the Willow Field and the 100,000 barrels, is that considered a new oil, or how does that oil field fall into the definitions of 21?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, that would most likely qualify for as new oil under the gross value reduction provisions of the tax law.
And then although you haven't included it in this forecast, you had said that the decline is at 4%. What year do you envision that Willow Field would be included reversing the 4% decline?
Yeah, Senator Hoffman, through the chair, we haven't studied that particular development in detail at this point. It was a very recent announcement and fell outside of the time horizon for the forecast. That's one that we'll definitely be looking at for the next forecast.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Commissioner Hoffbeck, I guess since you've been up on the North Slope, we're familiar with what's going on up there. You know, it's with great anticipation that we listened to the State of the State address last night, and the governor brought up the 1002 lands as well as the possible opening up of ANWR. When do you anticipate, what kind of numbers generally are we looking at in case that does become a reality? When can that be part of the forecast, if it is open?
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Olson, first, we'd have to get the federal legislation that allowed it to be open. Then, since there's only been one well drilled, there would have to be a fairly significant amount of work done to delineate the field. Even if they were to approve the drilling in ANWR this year, I would imagine it would be 10 years out probably before we would see oil in the pipeline from an ANWR development. That's speculation, but that's going to be in that time frame.
Last question, Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
And that has to do with what's the oil production anticipation in general numbers are we looking at if it is the 1002 lands are opened up?
Through the chair, Senator Olson, I'm not sure that we know enough to really make that call.
Would it double the production?
Senator Olson, through the chair again, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. We did a hypothetical analysis that we presented, I believe, last session or the session before to the House Resources Committee. And based on myriad assumptions, ANWR could be a very significant addition. I believe it was in the 500,000 barrels a day range, potentially.
I'm not talking about ANWR. I'm talking about 1002.
Correct.
And that just is in a 1002 lands alone.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yeah, and we'd be happy to make that information that we had put together available to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And again, our resource committee has notified me that they will do a deeper dive on the production side of the forecast. Mr. Stickle, please continue.
Thank you. So then, as we discussed, the official production forecast represents the sum of the currently producing, under development, and under evaluation categories. Most of the oil in our 10-year forecast does continue to come from the currently producing fields. This is Kuparuk, Prudhoe Bay, Colville River, and some of the smaller current developments. We have a small amount of under development oil that qualifies within that one-year time horizon, about 5,000 barrels per day in 2018, and a modest amount of under-evaluation oil from the new fields we see coming on. That oil stream peaks at 31,000 barrels a day in 2022. So in addition to the official forecast, the modeling developed by the Department of Natural Resources allows them to examine a range of possible levels of reservoir performance and provide a range of different production levels based on the underlying set of oil company activities. So they provide us with the official forecast, which is the most likely 50% case. They also provide us with a high case known as a P10, which represents a 10% chance of oil being produced at that level or higher, and they present us with a low case known as a P90, which represents a 90% chance of oil production meeting or exceeding that level. And so this next slide shows our official forecast as well as that high case and low case from the Department of Natural Resources. So in the official forecast, we decline at 4% annually, reaching 331,000 barrels per day of North Slope production by 2026. The high and the low case represent plus or minus about 40,000 barrels a day on that level. And again, this is before any of those potential new developments that are excluded from the current forecast. This table comes from page 37 of the Revenue Sources book and presents the information from the previous graph and table form. Additionally, this also shows the level of production estimated from those fields that qualify as new oil for the gross value reduction, which is a provision of the tax code. As you can see, the gross value reduction eligible production by 2026 goes down to zero. And the reason for that is some of the reforms to the tax system made in the previous legislative session that set new time limits for how long a field can qualify for that new oil provision. And next we have a comparison of the fall forecast to the previous spring forecast. As you can see, for the next several years, the forecast has been reduced from the previous forecast. Once we get out beyond 2023, there's actually a slight increase to the overall production forecast.
Brief at ease. Mr. Stickle, if I could ask you to go back one slide to slide 19 for those who are following at home in our presentation this morning. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Stickle, so keep this slide in your mind with those decline rates, and then can you click back to slide 10 real quickly, please? This has to do with Senator Hoffman's question. So you had a decline rate from 89 to about 99, and then we all remember the no decline after 99 stuff, right? So we flattened out from 99 through 04. And I'll have to go back and look at the forecast from that period of time, but, you know, you had a five-year period. Things were pretty flat. Did they consider the extreme decline rate of 89 to 99 in the 99 to 04 analysis, or did they begin to adjust for the changes in production? And I'm only asking that point because it seems like you sort of default to that 4 to 6%. How many years would it take of relatively flat production or even somewhat increased production before your decline rates assumptions would flatten?
Sure. Senator Michicki, through the chair, What we're doing now is we're looking at the range of potential developments out there as well as the level of drilling by the operators. If there was a significant uptick in drilling activity by the operators and field activity and some significant new finds that started to come into production, then that would be what would cause the production forecast to have a lower decline rate or maybe even flat production.
Senator Michicki, follow up.
At what point does actual production enter into that equation?
Sure, Senator Michicki through the chair. So in the Department of Natural Resources modeling, and they can speak in a little bit more detail on that, actual production is used to derive the currently producing forecast. They look at the production trends for each of the different oil pools as well as the level of drilling and investment in those pools and compare that to the projections going forward and plans of development.
One last, and this may be for DNR. Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking forward and thinking about the reset we talked about on the value of the commodity, is there also a segment of your forecasting that realizes certain fines will likely not be pursued if you stay at a certain price? I mean, do you have a probability at $50, probability at $60, a probability at something higher, and is that a factor you consider as well?
Yes, Senator Maticki, through the chair. For the oil and the under development and under evaluation categories, there is a price is one of the risk factors that's incorporated into the Department of Natural Resources modeling. So they do look at, you know, a lower price forecast would have a lower likelihood of having that oil come on, and they can speak in a little more detail on that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stickler. And the reason that we try to move through the chair just for the general public is not because I want to be in control, but our secretaries and those that are listening at home, if we have two male voices or two female voices, it's hard to transition if you're listening. So I don't mean to interrupt anyone. The reason I'm asserting that is to try to aid our Senate secretaries in making sure we have on the record who's appropriately speaking. So I apologize if sometimes it sounds like I'm interrupting. It's not the intent. It's just trying to make sure that we're saying it on the record that who is speaking. So thank you, Mr. Stickler.
Absolutely. All right. So we had just finished the slide comparing the fall production forecast to the previous spring production forecast. Moving on then to the oil price forecast. This chart shows a history over the past 7 years of Alaska North Slope oil prices, as well as the U.S. benchmark, which is West Texas Intermediate, known as WTI, and Brent, which is an international benchmark crude that has traded a lot closer to Alaska North Slope crude than the U.S. benchmark in recent years. As you can see, from 2011 to 2013, there was relative stability in oil prices in the $100 to $120 range, which made our job of forecasting oil prices a little bit easier. Then prices started declining in 2014, about halfway through the year, continued to decline throughout 2015. In 2016, we saw prices bottom very early in the year at about $26 a barrel, and prices have increased throughout most of 2016.
Mr. Stickler, we have a question.
Sure.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. Through the chair, there was a big gap between the West Texas and you can see in 2012. Which ones do you use then?
Sure. Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair. What was going on there is there was some issues specifically related to West Texas Intermediate crude. That crude is priced in Cushing, Oklahoma, and there were issues with the fact that the crude storage was landlocked, and with the rise in shale production, there was basically too much crude there, and they weren't able to move it out. So relative to worldwide oil prices, WTI was depressed for several years. So I think for purposes of comparing the value of our Alaska crude, looking at another waterborne crude benchmark such as Brent might be more appropriate. And so that's why we've included both benchmarks on this slide.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Senator Bishop, followed by Senator Dunleavy.
Just one little further. Thank you, Madam Chairman. Just to further expound on your question, Senator, is they completed the second leg of the Keystone XL pipeline from Cushing, Oklahoma to Tidewater, which then got our oil waterborne. And now you can see that the spread here is almost on par. So if you follow the graph. So, and there's been events in the last 3 days that for WTI to trade par with Brent.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Senator Dunleavy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Clarify for me again, there's been discussions that Alaska doesn't rely heavily on the international oil markets or prices, methodology determines price. Can you tell me how much do we rely on those international indices, projections, and how much do we do our own methodology within-house?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, I actually have a couple slides coming up here that will talk about our price forecasting process. So if it's okay, I can get to those. And if you have questions after that, we can discuss that.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. Please proceed.
Sure. So what are some of the key drivers that are impacting oil prices right now? We've noted spare capacity, which is the ability of the market to absorb a supply shock or an unexpected increase in demand for oil. Spare capacity is very low by historical standards, which all else equal would tend to provide support to prices. But at the same time, demand growth has been fairly weak across the globe, as well as there's lots of supply out there that could come on. OPEC is now mentioning that they're going to look at maintaining market share. There's also a lot of supply in the shale patch that, given a little bit higher oil price, could start to come on. So spare capacity is not necessarily having the upward drive on oil prices that it might have had in the past. The next chart shows some of the key events over the last 2 years relating to oil prices. As you can see, the low of 26.23 was reached in early 2016, just before the nuclear sanctions were lifted on Iran, and there was some concern that Iranian oil would flood the market. Since then, demand has actually performed a little bit better, and we've seen moves by OPEC to restrain supply. And so since the low in early 2016, prices have actually doubled, and the closing price of ANS crude 2 days ago was $54.83. This next slide just provides a little bit of context for some of the previous statements. This is a slide from the U.S. Energy Information Agency that looks at the relationship between oil production and oil consumption. For the last 2.5 years, production significantly outpaced oil consumption. So globally, we were putting oil into inventories at record levels. The projections of the Energy Information Agency and several other experts are that production and consumption will start to come into more of a balance, which would tend to support price stability. And as far as, for the next slide, as far as our own price forecast process, and this gets to Senator Dunleavy's question earlier, on October 4th, we held our fall 2016 price forecast session. And what we do there is we have a group of experts and stakeholders from within the state, primarily state government, which is Department of Revenue, Natural Resources, Labor, University, and we talk about oil prices for the day. We look at what outside experts are saying. We have some speakers that come and give us their views on oil prices. We examine futures markets, supply and demand fundamentals, take a real deep dive into oil prices for the day. And at the end of the day, we have each participant submit a price solicitation. They give us their most likely price path for the next decade, as well as a low and a high case. And those price paths are used to derive a the average of those derives a range of possible price outcomes, which are shown on the.
Mr. Stickle, you have an acronym, PERT distribution. Can you give us that production?
Sure, Madam Chair, that's a statistical term for. One method of taking a range of values and turning those into a.
You don't know what the acronym means?
Not off the top of my head.
That's
sorry.
That's fine. I just want to make sure we've got it in the meeting. Senator Dunleavy.
The Chair, before we move on, you touched on the heart of my question is, why do we go into a room and do this? Why do we not use what is already established or by people in a large room called the worldwide folks in terms of predicting oil prices? Why do we use some of that but then go into a room and then come up with our own prices?
Sure. Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, part of it is past practice. This has been the way the oil price forecast has been produced for quite some time. Another part of it is that we look at what all the different outside experts are saying and are really able to look at, are those reasonable? You'll have a situation where one analyst might be saying $80 a barrel and one analyst might be saying $40 a barrel. So I think there's some value rather than just choosing one of those analysts to go with to really evaluate what all of the analysts are saying and come up with a consensus forecast.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The governor last night talked about the gas line and prospects of more demand for gas. Japan and other nations are using that commodity more and more and diverting from the use of oil. And why don't we take that into consideration when we're looking at forecasting oil? The world seems to be moving toward cleaner consumption of petroleum products, and it seems as though that would be something that would be of great concern regarding falling of oil prices and not even maintaining them or increasing them.
Yeah, Senator Hoffman, through the chair, I think that's a really good point. We do look at various projections for oil demand and consumption growth over time when we put together our price forecast. And it is true that consumption growth going forward is expected to be a little bit, while still growing at a little bit lower rate than may have been the case in the past. And that combined with a lot of potential new supplies kind of helps set a little bit of a ceiling on oil price potential.
New supplies for gas or new supplies for oil?
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, new supplies for oil. There's a lot of shale finds and unconventional oils and even fields in places like Alaska that if oil prices were to increase significantly, there's a lot of potential new supply out there.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Senator Dunleavy.
Just going back to the previous issue, so past practice is a big part of why we do what we do?
Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, we have, yes. We have not had a strong reason to change the practice of bringing the group together and looking at what the various experts are saying and using that to help inform our forecast.
And one last follow-up, Madam Chair. The projections that this group or this process of using a group for Alaska, how closely, when you look back at the history, how closely has those projections mirrored the actual price outcomes?
Sure. Senator Dunleavy, through the chair, our success in forecasting oil prices has tended to be fairly similar to the success of other organizations. When you have a major run-up in prices or a major price crash, we definitely missed some of those, but so did other experts.
So your results are very similar?
Correct.
Then just one last question. Then why would we do this then? just trying to understand why we – is this because it's an Alaska thing and we're Alaska and we do things in different Alaska? Or?
Commissioner Hoffbeck.
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, for the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner of Revenue. I think it really comes down to the fact that every one of these forecasts tends to have its own bias in it. For instance, Goldman Sachs always seems to have the lowest forecast out there. Other organizations have a higher forecast. Somebody's going to have to take a look at all those different forecasts and compile them into an estimate of what we think the price is going to be, because picking one, I think we're just going to pick somebody else's bias. And so it's either going to be a couple of people in a room looking at the various forecasts and determining what it is, or we think there's actually some benefit in having a larger number of people all hearing the same information and then making a determination on what they think the proper forecast is. And you tend to take some of the bias out by having more individuals involved in the process. Is it absolutely necessary? No. But it's a process that's worked in the past, and it's a relatively inexpensive compared to the production forecasting in the past. With a contractor, we bring in a couple of speakers. Most of the time we do it teleconference or video conference, And so it's a 2-day process. It's not a terribly expensive event, but it does allow more input into the numbers.
Senator Dunleavy,
I'll get off this. I appreciate that. It just sounds like an Alaskan thing, and I just think, I mean, I can understand 30 years ago. You can get on the internet right now, and you can look at Goldman Sachs, everybody else, and if you want to, you could just hit a button and average that out.
Sure.
I was just wondering if we had known, if this process arrived at something better for Alaska, and then, of course, that begs the question, if it did, why doesn't the international community adopt Alaska's practice? And in other words, we seem to be coming up with the same results. Why do we do this? That's just the question.
Thanks. Senator Dunleavy, if I might try to put a finer point on that, in these tough economic times, we're wondering if we could rely on another forecast without expending the resources at a state level to deliver a similar value to the state. Is that accurate, Senator Dunleavy, or?
It is. It is, and also as we get very, very close to enacting potential revenue measures, there's going to be more and more scrutiny as how do we arrive at these figures that determine that we need more revenue.
Mm-hmm.
And those age, decades-old processes will probably be questioned as to why we're doing this. The forecast will be questioned. Are we doing this? Are there any politics involved in it? Is the forecast being lowballed so it makes a case for more revenue? These are questions that are coming now, so that's why I'm bringing these questions up, because there will be scrutiny over everything we do, including the going into the room thing that we've done for decades in Alaska that come up with the same results that the international community has come up with. That's all. It's just, why do we do what we do?
Through the chair, Senator Dunleavy, those are good points and certainly something that we can take under consideration.
Mr. Stickle.
Excellent. Thank you. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle with Department of Revenue. Thank you to whoever passed this note to me on slide 26. PERT, the acronym, refers to Program Evaluation Review Technique. And we'd be happy to follow up with some more information on that statistical technique if it would be helpful to the committee.
Mr. Stickle, and for the administration, if we're going to use acronyms or unfamiliar terms, the issue is that depending on the department that you're in, terms can mean different things, and that's the only reason I try to put on the record. Plus, we do have one member who hasn't been here for the last couple years when the acronyms get thrown around, so what may be easily understandable to us maybe not to the general public. And so it's not trying to put anybody on the spot, but just to remember that the people care about the people's business, and we're just trying to provide as much clarity in the conversation. Sometimes things aren't acronyms at all. So, it just might be something that an industry is used to using to refer to a particular action. So the more clarity we can bring so that we all have an equal understanding when we hear a presentation, the better. Vice Chairman Bishop.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick point, and I appreciate the discussion on the price and that whole discussion, but if the bottom line is, if you don't have any production and throughput, this price conversation is a moot point. So,
Senator Machicki.
Madam Chair, I don't normally peek at my phone and had some help from some staff here, but PERT seems to be Program Evaluation Review Technique, and it was developed by the Navy in the 50s. And it takes, in Monte Carlo simulations, it takes a lot of different complicated factors. And I'm not sure we need to go into that level of detail, but sometimes acronyms are just easier to leave off and talk about.
Exactly.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
Thank you. So this next slide shows the distribution of potential price paths that came out of the price solicitation. As you can see, we have a high case and a low case price path that was derived, as well as the median 50% case, and we've also identified some other cases within that range. Our forecast for the fall forecast is the 50% median most likely case that came out of the price session, which has prices increasing slowly from current levels, reaching a little over $91 in fiscal year 2027. In terms of real prices, if you back out inflation, prices settle in a $70 to $75 range in real terms.
Mr. Stickle, I have a question. We start from one point for what we actually have today, and it seems that there's a fairly equal distribution on the scenario. So that's just playing today out over the future at different percentages is what it looks like to me. If we overlaid the national organizations that Senator Dunleavy was referring to earlier, would we see volatility in that forecast?
Sure, Madam Chair. And I do have a slide coming up in a couple slides that looks at one. I don't know if we want to jump ahead to that one. So this slide looks at, just for the next year and a half, the price forecast assumption from the Energy Information Agency, as well as the futures curve. And as you can see, through the end of 2017, in the most likely case, they both suggest prices in the $50 to $55 range, which is similar to our forecast. They also add a high and a low case to this chart, which shows that there is a lot of potential volatility and uncertainty. Prices at the end of 2017, according to the Energy Information Agency, could be anywhere from $30 to about $95.
Mr. Stickle, does the U.S. Department of Energy have any forecasting that's available also?
Madam Chair, this the Energy Information Agency is the price forecast, or they do the price analysis within Department of Energy. Yes.
Thank you, Senator Machicki.
So, well, a lot of the questions we've had have been kind of based on the cost of supply, and I just a quick question: is there a global average cost of supply where we're placed out of the market, or is there something local where there would be a differential, local meaning West Coast distribution, right? Or is there something local that would revise, in your view, the future value of Alaska away from that global cost of supply?
Senator Machicki, through the chair, I think in terms of oil, in particular, Alaska is going to compete on a global level for investment in new finds. And some of the information that we've looked at, I didn't include a slide in this particular presentation, but we did have some in our forecasting session over the fall, look at the available tranches of new potential supply and the oil price that would be needed to bring those on. There is a lot of, you know, there's a certain amount of supply that could start to become economic at $50 a barrel. There's a certain amount at $60 and $70 and so on. And that's something we'd be happy to provide.
Thank you, Mr. Stickle. And we were referring to slide 29 that we advanced forward to, and we'll return back to slide 27 or 28.
I think we can move to slide 28. So what slide 28 looks at, this is an interesting chart. For the history of 2010 through 2016, we show what was the average price for that fiscal year, as well as what was the range of prices within the fiscal year. So you see in 2013 and 2014, the volatility of price within the fiscal year was very, very low, which is pretty unusual by historical standards. Looking, for instance, at 2015, the average price was a little over $70 a barrel within the year. Prices started over $100 a barrel and ended around $50 a barrel. For the forecast of 2017 through 2026, what these bars represent is our official forecast, as well as our high case and low case forecast. So it kind of gives a view of where prices have been and the range of where prices may go in the future. Then we talked about slide 29 already. Moving on to slide 30, this allows the user to answer the question of what if prices for the rest of FY17 were at a certain level, what would that mean for the ending price for FY17? Our forecast for FY17 prices is $46.81 based on 5 months of actual and 7 months of forecast, we were anticipating a price of between $45 and $50 for the remainder of FY17 when we produced that forecast. So, for instance, today prices are closer to $55 a barrel. If that level were to remain for the remainder of the year, you'd end up closer to $51 for your final FY17 price. So maybe about $4 a barrel higher than our forecast.
Mr. Stickle, for those listening at home, production comes in by month to the state. Is that accurate?
Figures. Madam Chair, that's correct. We receive daily production of figures, and then those are trued up to monthly production figures, and we receive production taxes on a monthly basis.
Mr. Stickle, and the depending on the month that we're looking at, the production can be either higher or lower. Is that accurate?
Compared to our forecast?
No. In January, is the production the same as July, or are those numbers different?
Excellent. Madam Chair, the numbers tend to be different. There's a seasonality to oil production. Typically, the summer is when maintenance activity and turnaround is done, as well as with reservoir dynamics and the impact of temperatures, they're able to produce oil at a higher rate in the wintertime compared to the summertime.
So as we're looking at production now and have a few winter months behind us, we have a fairly solid base to project forward based on other years where we know maintenance and other things happen during those lower production months to produce a greater confidence level in at least the production numbers?
Madam Chair, that's correct. The more production data you have, the better handle you have on what's going to happen for the rest of the year.
Thank you.
So moving on, the final slide I have for price forecast is a comparison of the current fall 2016 forecast to the previous spring 2016 forecast. As you can see, we have increased our price forecast for the duration of the forecast period over the previous forecast, but still not expected to get up to that $100 barrel range again.
Senator Hoffman.
And with the difference in forecasts, what additional revenue does that anticipate? Is that around $100 million more a year?
Sure, Senator Hoffman, through the chair. It depends looking on the different years. I think the commissioner mentioned earlier that...
For next year.
Yeah, for next year, a $1 increase in oil price is about a $30 million revenue increase. And I actually have a set of slides towards the end of the presentation that will compare the fall and spring forecasts. So the next component we look at in producing the petroleum revenue forecast is costs. Company lease expenditures are deductible from Alaska's production tax because it's a net-based tax, and lease expenditures are also a factor into determining the value of many of the credits. They also provide a good barometer of industry activity in Alaska. Looking at capital expenditures first, there's been a fairly significant reduction to expected capital expenditures in FY17 and FY18. In talking with the companies, they're reducing costs in response to the low oil prices wherever they can in many cases. You've seen announcements of less rigs being operated at the major fields. Certain projects have been canceled or pushed out into the future. So we've seen 17 and 18 have come down. Following that, we're seeing fairly stable capital expenditures expected, though at the lower level. Again, this is not including any of the development expenditures for a Smith Bay or a Pica or a Willow or any of those major new developments that could increase the forecast above and beyond this level. In terms of operating expenditures, the expectation is also for lower costs. We've seen layoffs by some of the oil companies, renegotiations of contracts and other activities to bring costs down, and we see fairly stable operating costs after that. So The final piece of the oil revenue calculation is tax credits. Alaska has a numerous different tax credits written into the production tax code. Those can be taken against a tax liability if a company has sufficient revenue to generate a tax liability to the state. And certain credits, such as the net operating loss credit, can also be repurchased by the state in cash. So this first chart shows a relationship between our forecast, well, actual for 2016 and then forecast for 2017 and 2018. The relationship between production tax revenue before any tax credits, which is shown on the blue line. For instance, in 2018, we're estimating about $500 million in production tax liability before credits. The next line shows production tax revenue after application of credits against liability. So we're forecasting about $100 million of production tax that will actually be paid into the state as production tax revenue. And then if you subtract against that the expectation for state repurchase of tax credits, it basically takes that to just above zero. One note in this slide and the following slide, we have made an assumption for FY18 that the amount of tax credit repurchases will be as proposed in the governor's budget, which is based on a statutory appropriation laid out in AS 4355028 that allows for either 10% or 15% of the production tax revenue to be deposited into the oil and gas tax credit fund. And I know that gets a little bit technical, but just to clarify what went into this slide, and then at the end of FY18, under that assumption, there would still be about $887 million of tax credits left on the books that are available for repurchase. And I'll go into a little bit more detail on that in two slides. The next slide is the same presentation comparing revenue to credits. This looks at unrestricted petroleum, total unrestricted petroleum revenue, which is the production tax as well as unrestricted royalty revenue, corporate income tax, and property tax, and how that relates to tax credits. So you see that, for example, in fiscal year 2018, even after application of credits, we're anticipating net unrestricted revenue to the state of over $1 billion from the oil industry. If you were to look at this chart a third way and include those restricted oil revenues, such as the royalty to the permanent fund, that amount would be even higher. So then moving on to the credits available for repurchase again. This slide shows the relationship between total credits repurchased by the state. These are for the companies that do not have enough of a tax liability to offset all of their credits. So a company that may not have production goes out, drills a well, earns a credit for that well, and applies for repurchase to the state. In fiscal year 2016, $500 million was appropriated to the oil and gas tax credit fund to repurchase those credits, and that turned out to be just enough to cover requests during fiscal year 2016. In fiscal year 2017, after the governor's veto, there was only $30 million appropriated to the fund, which left $646 million of credits available for repurchase outstanding at the end of fiscal year 2017. In fiscal year 2018, if you assume the statutory appropriation, which would be 15% of production tax, there would be $887 million in tax credits left available for repurchase at the end of 18. And then carrying this forward for illustration purposes, we plotted out what would happen if only the statutory minimum appropriation was made every year through 2026. All else equal, if that does not result in a change in company behavior, we'd have about $1.6 billion in outstanding tax credits available at the end of FY 2026.
Mr. Stickle, you said something interesting. Does the administration have a goal to change behavior by only paying out the statutory minimum and then what behavior are you trying to change?
Madam,
you don't have statute. That's not what I'm asking. Yeah. You're trying to use a stick or a carrot, and I'd like to know what you're trying to achieve and change.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Hoffbeck.
For the record, Randy Hoffbeck, Commissioner Revenue. We're not trying to change behavior, but we recognize the fact that the paying only the minimum could change behavior, that some companies that are relying on the cash repurchase of those credits for capital to make further investments would not be able to make those investments and would have to pull back. And so we're not trying to change behavior, but we recognize the fact that if we only pay the minimum, that it ultimately may very likely change behavior. And we met with AOGA this morning, and one of the things that they pointed out was there's really two issues here. One, they'll adapt to whatever they reasonably believe is going to occur going forward, but they can't adapt to what happened in the past, and so if they were looking for relief one way or the other, it's really the outstanding credits already earned that's the bigger issue than the credits going forward, because they'll adapt as long as they know the rules going forward. So,
Mr. Hoffbeck, I have people that are lining up now to follow mm-hmm. up for that. I'm going to go first since it was my question. So what are the variables in adaptation that you're expecting? One variable is less production. It's not a goal, but a possible outcome from what you're doing, and that's been acknowledged. So what other variables have you considered on you doing the statutory minimums?
Madam Chair, I'm actually talking about what we've been told by AOGA, not necessarily what we've modeled on our side, or from various producers that we meet with individually, that they, you know, the use of credits to leverage capital would not occur. That wouldn't be a possibility anymore, because the payoff on the credits would not be immediate, and they would have to say, well, is it going to be 3 years? Is it going to be 5 years? How long is it going to be till the credits are paid off? And they said they'll adapt to that payoff schedule if they know what that payoff schedule is. And quite frankly, a lot of them have asked, just tell us when, you know, how fast they're going to be paid off, and we'll figure out what to do next. It's the uncertainty that's the problem. And so uncertainty is going to cause more damage than a plan that they can at least count on. And so That's kind of the message that they've delivered to us. We're not trying to change behavior, but we recognize that every lever we pull on this is going to have some effect. And the way that we talked about this morning with AOGA is we're trying to do what causes the least amount of damage, and we're looking to them to help us come up with a plan that does that.
Commissioner Hoffbeck, final follow up under. Under ACES and under the More Alaska Production Act, both pieces of taxation policy were trying to encourage smaller companies to come into our state to find additional resources for the people of Alaska to benefit from. And what's happening now with the tax credits, as I understand it, and please clarify, is that the smaller companies are now selling out to the big three, which we were trying to create competition, not necessarily against, but competition for the benefit of the people of Alaska. And so is that a known factor to the administration under consideration with the minimum tax, that we're actually, whether you were for or against ACES, whether you were for or against the More Alaska Production Act, both were consistent in trying to incentivize small companies to come into our state. And the lever that you're pulling, based on our fiscal situation, I understand, I'm not saying that, but based on that, we are decimating comes to mind. It's probably an overstatement of the world, but we are significantly reducing other players in Alaska to develop those resources. Can you comment on that? Am I accurate? Help me understand And I know that that's not your decision to make. Is that a lever that's under consideration for the administration and adapt as the companies adapt that they're now selling in a discounted way to other companies that actually have cash right now, that they'll be able to take 100% of those credits against us versus the smaller companies that would take the 100% but would incentivize those companies?
Yeah. Madam Chair, I think you've hit the nail on the head. I mean, that's the discussions that we have as well, is, you know, and we don't have the capacity to pay the credits, but yet the credits, the companies most harmed by not being able to cash the credits are the very companies that we were trying to incentivize to come up here. And so, that's the dilemma that we're working with. And so I think everything you said is exactly the kind of thought process that we go through every day in trying to figure out what to do.
Senator Hoffman, did you have a question?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. We heard the governor last night give a state of the budget to the people of Alaska, and he categorized the state's financial position as in crisis, and with a $3 billion deficit, and he had proposed two revenue changes, the motor fuel tax and the bill that we had passed last year. Even if we had passed those two this year, that would still leave a $2 billion deficit that we have. And looking at the fact that in a very short order we will be depleting our savings accounts, it seems as though this is the one area that is going to indebt the future citizens of the state of Alaska unless something is done or unless a major oil field is found. And I wonder, I think we've had this conversation before, does this chart give you concern, and does the administration plan on addressing this if it is a concern to the administration?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, it is a concern, and I think you'll recall last year when the governor introduced his bill, the series of bills, the idea was that if we could get the fiscal package passed, that his intent was to pay off all of the existing credits. We didn't get the fiscal measures necessary. He felt that it wasn't prudent to pay off the credits with the financial situation we were in, and so he paid the minimum amount that the statutes required, being very cognizant of exactly what Chairman McKinnon talked about, that was going to have some pretty dramatic impacts on some of the companies. Our goal is still to get the credits paid off. And we would like to do that as quickly as possible. To do that, we've got to have the revenue stream to do that. Going back to if we pass both of the pieces in the governor's plan right now, the motor fuel tax and the Permanent Fund Protection Act, under the structure that the governor is proposing, we would have if we're looking at $60 oil, and we're trying to balance the budget looking at kind of a long-term stable oil price, not at a lower price, that we'd be looking at $600 million to $700 million gap that we still need to fill. And so that's kind of the equation that we're looking at.
Well, I would calculate it north of that, probably about $1 billion, but that still does not give us the necessary funds to pay off all of the credits, does it? It still leaves us in a deficit situation with no reserves.
Senator Hoffman, through the chair, you're correct. We still need to either reduce spending in other places or increase revenues in order to close that gap, in order to stabilize our finances long term. The idea being that once we have a long term stable financial structure and that our cash flows are sufficient to meet our needs going forward, then we can look at using something like CBR monies to pay off the credits. But until we've got that, until we no longer need that as our backstop for budgetary shortfalls, it becomes a decision of where are we going to spend our money.
My final question, I guess, is one that I asked initially, is if it is of grave concern, does the administration plan on coming forward with structural changes to address that.
Mr. Hoffbeck.
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, the administration has a bill in its pocket that can deal with oil and gas tax credit issues in a fashion that we think is fair and balanced. But we are not putting it on the table now. We are actually looking for everybody and anybody's suggestions on how to get to the finish line. It will be introduced if it's necessary to get us to the finish line, and we'll bring it forward.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Vice Chairman Bishop, followed by Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There's going to be plenty of time for me to say what I really want to say right now, but in the essence of time, I just don't want us, and that includes all of us, to forget about the tertiary and secondary employers and employees that are waiting for a paycheck that might be going underwater. Thank you.
Madam Chair, could I just respond real quick?
Hoffbeck.
And my only comment to that is we understand that, we recognize it as well, and what we need to do is come up with something that's stable and predictable so that everybody can start to move forward again.
Senator Machicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We somewhat complicated that growing debt with our $70 million limit per company last year, right? And we put a preference on those with the highest proportion of resident workers, and then we gave the incentive for the lower payout for folks. We took some action under 247 to try to improve the situation, but does that $70 million per company max payout complicate the total payout of those credits?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki. It will, in sometime into the future. We've got that backlog of nearly $700 million of credits that are prior to that bill passing that we need to get paid off first. But then it will. I mean, my guess is the companies will adapt around that as well, and knowing what they're, again, what they've asked for is certainty. Just to be able to say at the beginning, when they do their budgeting, what they can expect the state's participation to be.
Senator Machicki, follow up?
No, thanks. Thanks, Madam Chair.
Mr. Stickle, Commissioner Hoffbeck, I know that our questions are delaying progress on the presentation. It appears we have a significant number of slides, so if we could continue back on the presentation, that would be helpful.
Absolutely. Again, for the record, Dan Stickle, Chief Economist with the Department of Revenue. The next set of slides has just a couple of comparisons between the spring and fall revenue forecast. I think we can probably move to slide 41. So compared to the spring forecast, as we mentioned, our oil price assumption for fiscal year 17 was increased by about $8 or 20% over the previous forecast. The oil production forecast was decreased by 17,000 barrels a day or about 3% compared to the spring forecast. Total deductible lease expenditures, these are those costs that can be taken in calculating a tax liability. The deductible lease expenditures actually increased by $400 million because of higher oil prices. There was more revenue available to offset. So you'll see in our documents we use two different terms for lease expenditures. One is these deductible lease expenditures, which is what is available to offset revenue in the production tax calculation. The other way we present it is total lease expenditures. Total lease expenditures, we've actually decreased that forecast as companies have been cutting back. The assumption of transportation costs came down by about $1.50 a barrel. And at the same time, total unrestricted petroleum revenue, our forecast increased by $262 million, which is 37% increase from what we were forecasting in the spring, which is consistent with the increase in value of the crude oil. Similar chart for the FY18 forecast. The value of the crude oil produced on the slope is expected to, that assumption increased by 36%, which led to a 40% increase in our unrestricted petroleum revenue forecast, or about $312 million more in petroleum revenue than we were anticipating in the spring forecast. So in terms of total revenue, we've talked a lot about petroleum revenue. We've talked a lot about unrestricted revenue. This chart shows all revenues from all sources to the state for FY16 history and then the 2 years of forecast. For unrestricted revenue, we received an estimated $1.5 billion in fiscal year 2016, and we're forecasting $1.4 billion in FY2017 and $1.6 billion in 2018. So the unrestricted revenue is that revenue that's available for the legislature to appropriate for any purpose. The next category is designated general fund revenue. That was about $400 million, and we're forecasting around $450 million for that. Designated revenue is customarily appropriated for a specific purpose. A good example of that is the alcohol tax, where half of the alcohol tax revenue is considered unrestricted general fund and half is deposited to the alcohol and other drug abuse treatment and prevention fund. So while that money is customarily appropriated through the statute, it is technically available for the legislature to spend as it pleases. Finally, federal revenue. We talked about that the federal government has different restrictions on the funds that come in that has to be spent in certain ways. And other restricted revenue is the final category. This includes historically all revenue to the permanent fund, constitutional budget reserve fund, different program receipts, any revenues that are restricted by constitution or debt covenant. And so in total, state revenue of about $5.8 billion in FY16 across all of those categories, and a little under $10 billion for FY17 and 18 in the forecast. So these budget categories you'll see throughout the revenue sources book, the four different designations of revenue, and these are consistent with what's used in the budget process by the Office of Management and Budget and the Division of Legislative Finance. The next chart shows the same data with a 10-year history and a 10-year forecast. You can see that total state revenue is expected to generally have an upward trend. The biggest piece of that is the expectation of higher investment revenues as the asset balances grow. Again, that's before any possible changes to investment strategy. And the next slide looks at some of the non-petroleum revenues that contribute to unrestricted general fund revenue. We talked about petroleum revenue at length. That's around 70% of the expected revenues. We also receive unrestricted revenue from a variety of taxes, corporate income tax, mining tax, a new marijuana tax, some excise taxes. And there's other non-tax revenue such as fines and forfeitures, rents and royalties on non-oil as well as charges for services and some miscellaneous revenues. A small amount of investment revenue comes into the general fund. The vast majority of investment revenue goes to other funds. And finally, as the commissioner touched on in his opening remarks, we have a new Chapter 1 in this year's Revenue Sources book that looks at revenue available for appropriation. And this is really our effort to better reflect the ability of the state to meet its obligations when talking about revenues to outside analysts or organizations that aren't familiar with all of the nuances of our budget process. So I think we can move to the next slide. Total revenue available for appropriation starts with unrestricted general fund revenue. Added to that is the designated general fund revenue, which is the money that's customarily appropriated for different purposes. This category also includes any settlements to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, as well as all earnings of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And finally, the largest addition in the revenue available for appropriation is realized earnings of the permanent fund are technically available for appropriation. So in terms of this view, we received about $4.5 billion of revenue in FY16 and expected to receive a little over $5 billion in 17 and 5.6 in FY18. So just a couple takeaways and wrap up. Starting from FY16, we're expecting increases in oil prices, averaging 7% a year, which leads to unrestricted revenue increasing about 5% per year on average over the 10-year forecast. We do have a new production methodology we've announced. The production forecast assumes a 4% annual decline over the next decade and does not include some of the major opportunities out there, such as Smith Bay or Pikka. Petroleum revenue is going to represent about 70% of our unrestricted revenue over the time horizon of the next 10 years, which is down from 80 to 90% in recent years. And finally, it appears that we have it appears that we've kind of turned the tide in terms of the message that we have to deliver to you guys. We have modest revenue increases in this forecast as oil prices have recovered, which is a contrast to the decreases that we had to deliver for several forecasts in a row as oil prices were declining. Investment income is a major asset to the state. We have over $53 billion in the permanent fund, and that income stream is expected to increase on average 5% per year over the next decade. A couple other trends that our staff noted. In addition to the recovery in oil prices, other minerals prices have also recovered over the past year, and we're looking at a significantly higher revenue from the mining license tax. While that's a small tax in terms of the revenue to the state, it's a very important industry to the state, and it's good to see that those minerals prices are recovering. And finally, one item you may notice in going through the revenue sources book is we have revenue from the NPRA fund in the forecast up to $45 million per year in 2024. What's going on there is we have the first new development on federal land in NPRA, which is the Moose's Tooth unit by ConocoPhillips, and a portion of those federal royalty revenues for that development will be coming to the state. So that's a really great development. And that's all I have. I'd be happy to take questions.
Any additional questions for Mr. Stickle or Commissioner Hoffbeck? Commissioner, any closing comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Thank you for joining us at Senate Finance today. If I could invite Chantel Walsh, the Director of the Oil and Gas Division, the microphone, if you could identify yourself for the record, and if you'd like to introduce yourself to the Senate Finance Committee, welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Chantel Walsh. I'm the Director of the Division of Oil and Gas in DNR. I thank you very much for giving me a moment. Our department, as you well know, is responsible for the production forecast in the presentation from DOR. And first of all, I want to applaud the conservative viewpoint that this group is taking towards trying to manage a budget and manage things that are forecasted in front of you. But I do want to take a moment and talk about our production forecast. While it's low to what's currently being produced on the North Slope, it's not really a conservative forecast. If you look at the decline on the North Slope, it's averaged far closer to 5%, and we're forecasting 4% decline. So although, you know, we've had some great stories out there, I applaud the oil companies. I applaud the Alaskan people who are out there, you know, making a change and a difference in these fields. But we're, in addition to the comments that Commissioner Hoffbeck pointed out as to why we're so high in this year, I mean, why we saw no decline and actually saw a bit of an increase, there are a couple of other things. The facility maintenance programs that are associated with the bigger fields like Prudhoe Bay, those being smaller is definitely an impact, but In 2014 and 2015, they had large downtimes associated with their facility maintenance, and they made great strides in pushing forward projects that make a difference and make more oil in the future. And we're riding that wave right now. But there's no one out there that believes that cutting back on oil rigs, cutting back on activity, having those kind of impacts is going to give us bigger production out of our heritage fields. That's just not reasonable. So I think while it may be high right at the moment, and we may get lucky by the end of the year and see a bit higher than what we projected, it's important to note that a 4% decline is not conservative in the bigger picture.
Thank you, Chantel. Ms. Walsh, any questions for Director Walsh? Thank you for joining us in Senate Finance today. We tried to make it an easy one.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that.
Is there anything else to come before the committee? Seeing and hearing none, the agenda for tomorrow, Mr. Teal will walk us through legislative finances overview of the governor's proposed FY18 operating budget. It is 10:49. We're adjourned.